So thank you for the invitation. So this talk is going to be mostly about scattering amplitudes applied to the problem of the binary spiral. It won't be that technical, so it will be mostly about pictures, hopefully. But it's a very new topic in this field, in scattering amplitudes. It has a couple of years. Of course, the interest grew up like crazy after the first observation of gravitational waves. So I have been involved in part of these developments. So I will be mostly be talking about some papers with some collaborators in Europe. So Alex, which is a postdoc at ETH. And Justin, who is a postdoc at Max Planck. And also, does this work? Oh, does it work like pointer? No.
I think it's pretty weak.
No. Okay, well. Is there a hockey stick? Okay.
No.
I tried them. And maybe it ran out of battery. Okay. So this is some work with Alex, Justin, and Fabian, who is here. He's a PhD at York and also at PI. Okay, so let me just remind you, the good thing about giving a talk about strong gravity here is that I don't have to motivate why studying gravitational waves is important. So I will just give you a brief catalog of some events which had been observed by last year. So this is just the first and second round of LIGO. So I will be mostly interested on this guy, the effective spin, which is related to the spin of the single guys entering the spiral, and about this guy, which is the radiated energy. So these guys are observables that we can measure. So let me tell you how to measure, but first let me point out that there is some problem. If you look at the spin sink, you will see that the confidence interval is too large. So actually, we cannot be certain as right now what is the spin of these guys. And it's consistent probably with zero, or maybe it goes to 0.5. It cannot be greater than one, so that's like 50-50. So we don't really know what is the spin of the single guys. We can measure the spin of the average guy, but we know that more precise measurements are coming. For instance, in LISA, and we know that more precise measurements require better templates. So if you're familiar with numerical ER, for instance, you would know that there's an analytical approach called the effective one-body approach, which actually is able to match certain predictions of numerical ER. So we actually need analytical templates, or at least that's what we can compute using scattering amplitude. So let me just give you, oops. Yeah, that's not supposed to. Okay, that's. So this is supposed to be like some animation. So it doesn't have to pop up all at once. Otherwise, you will be completely confused. So let me just do it. Let me just run it in the actual Google. How do I go out of this thing? Yeah, sorry about that. So I come here. Yeah, so yeah, now it's an animation. Yes, of course, of course. So so we have this quantum field theory thing that we know is very successful, and we want to see what of these tools we can apply to that thing, which is the black hole binary. So it's a very, very cool story. So we have conformal bootstrap, we have topological defects. I'm sure there are many people here working on that. In PI and for sure supersymmetric quantum field theories and so on. There are also less known approaches which are non-perturbative, which compute non-perturbative pieces of the pad integral. One example is this resurgence thing. And there is a very familiar for you good old perturbation theory, which we now call scattering amplitudes. So the reason we call it scattering amplitudes is because this part has suffered a very renewed interest during the last 10 or 15 years. So there have been incredible developments on how to compute these guys at very high orders. So right now, There are a couple of trending topics, which are first underlying geometry. So you might have heard about the amplituedron and some geometrical positive structures that control the behavior of the scattering amplitudes. There's also a double copy story, which is about relating some very complicated computations in GR. Not only scattering amplitude, but it was based on scattering amplitudes to simple computations in gauge theory. So this is usually stated as GR is Young-Mills square at tree level and also at loop level. Speaking of which, we also have the unitarity methods, which is probably is based on a standard unitarity of the S matrix, but now more refined to actually use only on-shell data. So this is mostly about using on-shell constructions to compute scattering amplitudes, on-shell building blocks. So there is also, finally, I'm just going to mention this last one, which is the IR physics. So this very well-known story in QCD, and there is a renewed interest as well because it's related to some asymptotic symmetries and Hayley black holes in flat space-time, as pointed out recently by Strominger. So we have all these kind of tools we can use in the perturbative expansion. Now we want to take a look at the other side. So on the other side, we have, well, for the merger, you may know that the best tool by the standard and the best tool is, of course, numerical GR. You also have perturbative GR for the spiral, which is actually an analytic approach. And there's this also effective field theory approach, which is actually very broad. So that's why it's kind of in between the two. So of course, there is a very nice relation, and there is an interplay between these two guys. So you can apply effective field theory methods to compute perturbative GR. So there is some set of non-relativistic Feynman rules and non-relativistic GR and so on, which exactly tells you the exactly gives you the result that you want to get. I mean, this thing is about separating the scales and only keeping the relevant ones. This one has also a nice interplay with that. That's what I said about the effective one-body method. So we have all these things, and now we want to relate them. So perturbative GR, you may have learned about weak field, the weak field expansion in your GR courses. Of course, this can be refined in the spiral case to the post-Newtonian expansion. And we will see there is another refinement of this, which is the post-Minkowskian expansion. And if I have time, I will talk a little bit about asymptotic structures. So this talk will be mostly about taking these three insights from scattering amplitudes and mapping them directly to this side. So we want to get observables. So amplitudes give you on-shell observables, which can be related to the spiral phase. Specifically in the post-Minkowskian expansion, which we will show it contains the post-Newtonian expansion. And of course, there's much room to play with, and maybe there is another kind of tool that we don't know yet in the coalescence thing, which can be, of course, mapped to some non-perturbative statements. So it's always worth keeping that in mind. So we're only working at this lower level right now. Okay. So let me motivate the duo problem as a scattering.
Can I ask you something? Yes. So I mean, the first word that I had on the left was quantum, and I guess the black hole merger is classical.
Yes.
So, I mean, why do we have to care about quantum and stuff?
Okay. So what this arrow really means is a classical limit, and in this case, I will be very precise how to take the classical limit. As in the following slides. And in this case, we really don't know. But the claim is that all the classical information is distributed in all orders in the coupling. So you actually would like to compute some non-perturbative observable and then take the classical limit. So let me try to explain you how to do that. But first, well, this is the post-Newtonian expansion. You may have seen it. This condition, which is implied by the Virial theorem, And what you do with this post-Newtonian expansion from this perspective, if you try to compute this off-shell potential mode, so you want to find these configurations in which the momentum transfer between the two massive guys has this form. So it scales as B over R in the time-like component and 1 over R in the spatial component. So this form exactly gives you an instantaneous potential. So it gives you a potential in the near zone region, no retardation effects. It's valid in at distances way shorter than the radiation that you're looking at. So it's a potential that basically controls the dynamics. But if you go far away when you want to measure things, so when you actually want to look at the radiation, you will have to look at a more relativistic version of this object. So you will have to look actually at on-shell modes instead of off-shell modes. So that's what the post-Minkowskian expansion gives you. So the post-Minkowskian expansion gives you the on-shell information, which you would get by solving the linearized or the Einstein's equation at up to some order in G. So in this case, the velocity is not an expansion parameter. It's completely relativistic, whereas we actually expand in the coupling. So this is exactly what we would do if we have to do perturbation theory in Einstein equations without taking care of what's the source that's generating the waves. And it's actually what the scattering amplitudes do for you. So scattering amplitudes are nothing but a clever way of solving this perturbation problem. And a very nice thing happens. So you may be familiar with the fact that, well, post-Minkowskian, meaning expansion in G, actually gives you the radiation field. But a very nice thing happens when you want to look at post-Newtonian orders from this perspective without expanding in the velocity. So sometimes it so happens that you can get all orders in the velocity for a given order in G. And we will see that there's a very good reason for that. But in principle, if you are in the post-Newtonian expansion, each time you want to go one order in the velocity, you have to do a completely different computation, or you have to put much more effort into getting more and more orders in the velocity. Now, of course, in the post-Newtonian case, orders in the velocity are equivalent to orders in G. So you may say, why do we want to compute all these orders if we don't have the actual expansion in G? Well, the answer is because you can, and because you can do it very nicely with no effort. So in this case, you can see, for instance, that this thing stops here. So blue means post-Newtonian, and at this order, we have post-Minkowskian information, and we have post-Minkowskian information to all orders here. And last year, the state of the art was exactly 2 p.m. So last year, this was known in the post-Minkowskian information, in the post-Minkowskian setup. But this year, we actually had a very cool paper by S.P. Baron and some collaborators understand how to compute this order at all orders in the velocity, but fixed order in G. So this is a G cube computation. It's a two loop computation, and it was done using scattering amplitudes. So this is a nice example in which the application of scattering amplitudes methods actually gives you more information than the standard PN theory. And spin, sometimes you want to do it also with spin, because you may have heard that astrophysical black holes, mostly from electromagnetic radiation, we know that they are maximally rotating or close to maximally rotating. So we want to get information about spins, in fact, also at all orders. So we can do it at the first post-Minkowskian orders. We can resum all the expansion in a spin. So
what are you actually computing?
Yes, so this is going to be the post-Minkowskian potential. So this is what you get if you take the post-Newtonian potential and you fix the power of G, but start summing all the orders in the velocity. So I will show you some examples. So let's talk about scattering amplitudes now. So the idea is to compute observables from a two-body scattering amplitude. So two-body basically here means two particles. So particle of species A and particle of species B. This amplitude is going to give you, of course, you know that if you do it for QED, you're going to get Coulomb potential. If you do it for gravity, you're going to get Newton potential. But that's only the lean order in G and in the velocity. So you can actually get more than that. And to get more than that, you have to know how to take the classical limit. So the classical limit is defined in a simple way by taking the limit of large angular momentum. And the reason for that is that this guy, the radius of the that separates the two massive guys, is basically scaling as the conjugate of the momentum transfer. So the momentum transfer is a wavelength, so you want it to scale as 1 over h bar. And p is also small if you want, but it's not as small as r. So actually, this r guy is very large because it has 1 over h bar. And that's exactly the scaling that's going to define the classical limit. So you take your amplitude, and you look at the piece that scales with h bar equals to 0. And that's going to take in this large angular momentum thing. So what can you get? So you can get potential, but you can get it in a very clear way, which is computing observables, which are gauge invariant, which are frame invariant, so they actually don't depend on the way you compute them, and then can be mapped to a potential in a certain canonical gauge. So we want to actually get these guys. So the first one is a scattering deflection. So it's basically a scattering angle of one guy going to the other, from initial to final, and having some deflection. In the case it's elastic scattering or conservative dynamics, if you want, the scattering deflections cancel. And if there is some inelastic scattering or non-conservative dynamics, we can compute the radiation field. And from this guy, we can get all the observables that you would read at null infinity. So you can get the radiated energy, the radiated momentum, the frequency spectrum, and so on. So all this is contained in this radiation mode. And of course, once you get these guys, you have complete control over the dynamics. So I tell you how the momentum is deflected as a function of the impact parameter, and you can give me a potential if you fix some coordinate, of course. So this guy was introduced recently by these people, and it's actually a very, very complicated guy. This guy is also very complicated at one loop. This guy is already complicated at three level. Even if you take the classical limit, it's still complicated. Even if you don't put a spin on it, it's still very complicated. So let me just show you. I should show you this later, but I couldn't avoid to show you exactly how we're going to do this computation. And we are going to do it by splitting this guy, by factorizing this guy into fundamental building blocks. So these amplitudes here, you can see they are the same. These are 3-point and 4-point amplitudes. These are actually fundamental objects. They have very, very, very simple properties that you can fix by gauge invariance and so on. And these guys, once you want the classical part, you can glue them. So every time I say glue, I really mean, well, using unitarity, but to construct this cut. So unitarity means you have to sum over internal states here. So you compute these guys, the 4 and the 3-point amplitude, and you're done. You have the one loop potential, or the G squared 2pm if you want, and the linear order radiation field, which is something that I did with Fabian recently, and this was done with Freddy a while ago. So let me, of course, this is like a spoiler, but of course you should know that if you actually go to do this one loop computation, you have to add up Feynman diagram. So if you don't do the cut thing, you basically will have to deal with graviton three-point vertices and so on. So this is already not very nice. If you put a spin, the thing gets worse. So this is part of the answer that you're gonna get if you just go to linear ordering spin. So yes, the dipole. Just the dipole information of one guy interacting with the dipole of the other guy. So you're going to have very complicated kinematic factors. And you will actually, in this case, you will recognize some common structures. So there are some tensor structures that will be, so this is part of the potential now. So in the potential, you will recognize this coupling, for instance, between a spin and spin. And this is this. A spin orbit coupling, so it's just this is just a dipole, and so on. So this somehow hints that there is a nice way of organizing this thing by looking first at these kind of structures and regarding these other guys as form factors, which is the standard thing that one would do when computing an amplitude in QED. So one looks at the structures, and then there's some form factor that you compute at one loop and so on. So there has to be a nice way of organizing all this information in a spin. So all this multiple expansion has to be somehow encoded. And let me show you what. So this is where I have to introduce the soft theorems. So what do we learn, or what can we get from these soft theorems? Well, this is probably very specific, at least it was very specific to scattering amplitudes a couple of years ago. So I will have to introduce it from the start. So this guy, let's say it's a massive particle. So it can have some internal structure. It can be a neutron star or a black hole rotating or whatever. But you want to take this guy in flat space-time and solve the linearized Einstein equations order by order. So the first order, you just plug this guy as some whirling source, and you solve for the stress energy tensor, which radiates. So at some point, it starts accelerating during a finite interval of time. Doesn't really matter what was the size of the interval. And you do this computation, but you get only, you drop the Coulomb mode, so you drop the potential modes, because you want to study radiation. So you only keep this piece that's going to give you the 1 over R thing once you Fourier transform. And this is what you get. At lean order, in the momentum of the graviton, or of the gravitational wave, at lean order, this thing doesn't really care about the internal structure of the object, of the massive object. And it doesn't really care about the acceleration function. So it can really have some acceleration which is linear or is instantaneous. But if you look at very far from very far away, you're not gonna really care about the details of what's going on in this time. So you're only gonna see this factor, which is called the Weinberg soft factor. And in fact, it was Weinberg in the 70s who showed that this behavior for scattering amplitudes is universal and is independent of the internal structure. Now, this already hints you that this object is actually very much related to a three-point scattering amplitude, meaning the field that you would compute as the stress, as the current associated to this amplitude, as the Onshell current, is exactly what you get by accelerating this massive guy in flat space-time. So this is already a very nice analogy. Now, this guy is very simple, actually. You cannot compute many things that can be this. So let's see what happens if you actually put it on shell. So if you take P2 to be P1 plus Q, and P2 and P1 are in the mass shell, what you're going to get is just this simple factor. So this is, roughly speaking, the stress energy tensor of a field, of a scalar field, which actually is quite universal at lean order in the momentum of the graviton. But you also get this delta function, because, well, it comes from the denominator. But what does the delta function mean? So if you look at it, for actual real kinematics, so a real situation in which P1 and Q are on shell and real, this actually doesn't have support. So this delta function always kills the full amplitude. So the amplitude is zero. So there is no support for radiation. But somehow you expected that because, well, this guy is not really accelerating. It's just emitting some graviton. But somehow, if you want to see radiation, you have to include an external force. So you have to have something like a four-point amplitude if you want to see radiation. This guy by itself is not going to radiate. But it's still useful in complex space. It's still useful to construct bigger amplitudes. So this is a standard thing in the scattering amplitudes, where the three-point amplitude is completely unphysical. So you may say it vanishes in real space. But it serves as a building block to construct bigger objects, because it's an actual on-shell, if you use an actual on-shell method. So a couple of remarkable things. This is actually unique. What does it mean? You cannot basically write down anything else which had two indices using because of the on-shell conditions. So it's just fixed by the little group or the spin of the graviton. So it has to have two indices. You cannot put Q here because it's orthogonal to polarization, so it's not transverse. And this is the only thing. And then there's also an interesting thing, which is the double copy. So if you look at it, it really looks like the double copy of a QED vertex at linear order. So the QED answer will be if I put a photon here, I will get just P1 mu with just one index. So it has this trivial double copy thing. But this is the starting observation to build higher order results. OK, so now what about spin? So I told you that at linear order, there is nothing else. But if you go higher and higher in the soft momenta, you will see internal structures, right? So you will see actually information about the composition of this subject. Now, of course, this is a word line. So how can you put internal structure in a word line? Well, what you do is you put a tetra. So you put a frame that somehow mimics what you would have if you actually did this computation for the Kerr black hole. So if you want to simulate a Kerr black hole from the perspective of effective field theory or from far away, you're actually going to put this guy into a word line. And this is exactly going to match the computation in linearized year. So this tetrad is going to define some angular velocity, some internal angular velocity, some rotation, the conjugate of which we call a spin. And this spin is mapped to the standard ring singularity radius. So this is the thing that will model a Kerr black hole, and it has some internal structure parameterized by these guys. Now, what happens in the amplitude? So I told you already that this guy was in the scalar case, or in the Allene order associated to a three-point amplitude. So let's see what it looks like if you actually put a spin into these guys. So now, instead of putting this tetrad, you're going to put particles which are spinning. And you will find that the Allene order is the same. So I told you already that this part is universal. But the sub-Allene order, so this guy goes with k now. So it's one order more in the momentum of the graviton. It's actually not quite universal, or at least you cannot fix it just by writing the most general thing. So you will always have this g factor, right? But and this is also the standard thing in QED, where you have this gyromagnetic ratio, and you have to compute it just by doing one loop triangles and so on. Now we have gravity and we have this g factor, but it was observed a long time ago. That the Kerr black hole has a g equals 2, so it behaves like an electron for gravity. So this guy is not the geomagnetic ratio; it's the gravitomagnetic ratio. But so anyway, this guy has g equals 2, and this is actually fixed from a very general statement, which is you cannot couple anything to gravity or any kind of field which doesn't have g equals 2. So this is just basic general covariance. If you write down a Lagrangian, you covariantize it, then you start trying to add non-minimal couplings. Non-minimal couplings are always going to be here. So they are not going to affect g, and g is always going to be 2 by general, yeah.
If g is slightly off the value of 2, what would that imply or point of gravity?
Well, yeah, so that will have some problem with gauge invariance, basically. So, yeah, so I told you already that this guy was universal. So the fact that this guy is universal is very closely related to the soft theorem, and in fact is closely related to the equivalence principle. So this guy here follows from the Weinberg soft factor, as I showed you, which is basically telling you that gravity couples to anything in the same way. Now, if I tell you that this guy has g equals 2 always by a general principle, you may suspect that there is also a condition that restricts this guy to be universal. So, but this guy is already the sublinear order in the soft factor. But it turns out that Cacciasso and Strominger in 2014, they found that actually gravitational amplitudes have a sublinear soft theorem, and that soft theorem is controlled by the angular momentum. And it turns out that if you use that sublinear soft theorem in the derivation I show you, you will be able to fix g equals 2 always. Not, of course, you won't be able to fix these guys. So what happens with these guys? So what happens with the quadruples? So you can add quadruples.
Sorry, before example, you run, I don't understand what you're saying. It said for Kerr black hole equals two. So what process are you looking at for Kerr black hole when you can't compute this?
Yes. So you take the stress energy tensor of the Kerr black hole, and then you just expand it in powers of the angular momentum.
But the Kerr black hole doesn't have a stress energy tensor, so I don't.
No, sorry. What I meant is you take the word line source that reproduces the if you use it as a source, it reproduces the metric of the Kerr solution.
So there is a Kerr black hole that's being accelerated somehow. And it's emitting gravitational.
No, this guy is static. So this guy is static so far. This is a 3-point amplitude. But so nevertheless, it acts as a source because you can get a non-zero solution of Einstein's equations if you put this guy as a source. So that source we interpret as the in the effective field theory, we interpret that as a word line which generates the Kerr black hole. So it's like a spinning particle, which doesn't have an horizon because it's some effective approach. But so far, it's the thing that you can use to compute two-body scattering. So you can put two of these guys and some, and then reproduce the scattering of two spinning black holes. Where was it? Okay, so these guys are not fixed. So that means the quadruple part actually is kind of it's controlled by some tensor structure, but it has a non-fixed form factor. So people recently have shown that the sub-Savlian sub-theorem is actually not universal, and it depends on the EFT operators that you put in your action. Or if you want to put it in terms of gravitational waves, you can see that this guy is really the thing that marks the difference between a black hole and a neutron star. So neutron stars have different quadrupole coupling than the Kerr black hole. And it turns out that you can actually repeat, you can actually simulate neutron stars or Kerr black holes by just putting different quadrupole coupling in this spinning particle. So the question is, how do we fix those? So how do we fix these higher multiples to match the Kerr black hole? And we need to consider spin S particles. So if you consider spin 0, you're always going to get this. So you have to go higher orders in the spin of the sky to see these higher order multiples. And the question is, are these universal in any sense? We've seen that the first two actually are. So one solution is to actually consider minimal coupling. So minimal coupling has to be defined in a very precise way when you have higher spin particles, because they don't have massless counterparts. So there is a very precise definition of minimal coupling given by Nimar Kanihamed and some collaborators. And in this paper, I use this definition to actually compute this 3-point amplitude and some 4-point amplitudes as well. And it turns out they actually match what you would expect from the Kerr black hole. There is also this paper with my collaborators where we do it more explicitly, and also this paper where it's actually very, very explicit as well. So that's a way of doing it. You can impose minimal coupling, but there is a new way of doing it, or at least a new criteria. So remember that these guys have always G equals 2 for gravity, but they didn't have G equals 2 for QED. Now, if you assume that gravity is somehow given by the square of QED, then this fixes G also for QED. So if you use that criteria, you will find that when the double copy holds, meaning this 3-point amplitude squares to a gravitational amplitude, this guy has to have the gyro magnetic ratio fixed to 2, whereas this guy doesn't really care. It's always 2. But it turns out that if you just impose this relation at all orders in the spin, so all multiples controlled by this double copy thing, you actually find that it's a very powerful constraint by the simple fact that you can put any S and any S tilde here. And you will always have to have this kind of relation. So how does it work? Well, you take the dipole guy of this object, so the G equals just the dipole part, linear angular momentum. You just tensor product them. And this gives you an operator which acts on a spin 2s representation if you use S and S here. So S and S is dipole times dipole, and you will always get some part that's quadratic in J. So it looks like something like this. So it's Fj squared. So this is a way in which you can get the quadruple part. If you assume that these guys have a dipole with J equals 2, you will always get this guy in a precise form. And you can keep doing it. You can do it at all orders in spin, and you will find this solution. You will find that the sinc has to be an exponential. You can kind of guess it by noticing that the exponential, when you have product, then you got a sum of angular momentum. So it's not surprising, but this is actually the only solution of this relation. Doesn't mean that all theories have to behave like that, but the ones that satisfy this double copy criteria have to behave like exponentials, and you can expand it to any order you want. Turns out if you use finite representation, so if you use like a trivial representation, a scalar field, this guy acts trivially, so it's 0, and so on. This guy is 0, 0, 0, and you will get only 1. If you use a finite representation, it will always truncate. So this is actually not a finite series, but it's actually a finite up to some order, which is exactly the order of the spin you are considering. But nevertheless, these coefficients, the form factors, are always fixed. And you can actually compute the Kerr stress energy tensor. What do I mean by that? Take the Kerr solution, write it as a source, or write it as the solution of some source, and then expand that source, which is this Wurlen action, in a linear order in G, but all orders in the ring radius, and you will find that it behaves exactly like that in momentum space. So this is the amplitude counterpart that reproduces the Kerr black hole. That's not very interesting because we know Kerr solution to all orders, but it's very interesting when it comes to putting two Kerr solutions, one against each other, which is what we want to do. So what can we say about this new three-point amplitude? So first of all, you may notice that it behaves like a Lorentz transformation in the sense that it maps this P1 to P2. It maps a state of spin S to a state of, a state of spin S for particle 1 to a state of spin S for particle 2. And it's actually a non-compact thing, so this is actually a non-unitary thing, but nevertheless, that can be refined in a very nice way that I don't have time to explain. But anyway, there is this exponential, and you can actually glue them if you want to compute factorization channels. So this guy preserves the reducible representation of the Lorentz group. That means you can literally sum our internal particles by multiplying them. That's not usually what you do. You have to put projectors. But now you can just multiply these guys, and you will get a bigger exponential, just a bigger Lorentz transformation. You can always write it as some product of epsilon 2, this guy, times some new epsilon 2, which is rotated by this transformation. So this guy may seem useless because it's giving you a particular factorization channel. So it's not giving you the full amplitude. It's giving you a cut. But it turns out that at the order we want, this is all we need. So we just take two of these guys, glue them, and that gives us the Compton amplitude. And why is it important? Because the Compton amplitude is a four-point amplitude, which is the building block for radiation at linear order, and 2pm scattering angle, which is basically 2pm effective potential. At least up to S to the 4, there's a reason for that. You cannot get too many powers of J here. If you get so, there will be this pole, and then you cannot keep exponentiating because this pole is not physical. So basically, you can get up to exadecable order, which is quite high enough, and it's actually way above all the state of the art computation of the effective potential. So let me show you how to do it. If you are in four dimensions and you can pick this gauge up to spin 2. The Compton amplitude for two massive spin particles behaves like an exponential as well. That's not very weird because it's obtained by gluing exponentials. And just by using this exponential in this cut, where this guy is an exponential and this guy I already showed you is an exponential, you can get the scattering angle, which is controlling the deflection of P1 going to P2. So this is standard. This is called the Conan approximation. It's a thing that you would do in QCD as well. In the limit where the impact parameter is large. So you put the exponential objects and you will get this object here. The prescription for taking this cut is given by a contour integral. So that thing is slightly technical, but nevertheless it's something that you can put in Mathematica. And the fact that it's exponential tells you that you can actually Fourier transform the thing trivially. So you just get this pole here. Now this may look or may not look like a very complicated object, but you have to bear in mind that this actually can be expanded in A, B, and AA. So these guys are the ring radius of the two Kerr black holes. So you can expand at any order up to any order you want. And it doesn't look like complicated. It doesn't look that complicated if you actually compare it to an actual given order in the expansion, which is like this. So this is the linear order in expansion in the spin. And it's already a mess. So the point is that even though this prescription is technical, it condenses or it encodes way more information than the expanded answer. So AB and AA here can be expanded. There is a restriction in that this Compton amplitude is only valid up to spin 2. But nevertheless, they can be expanded in AA or orders. So this gives agreement to all orders in the velocity, all orders in A, and up to certain order in A cube. So why is it not A4? Well, because no one has computed so far the A4 or the four order in spin from the classical perspective. So the best we could do is just to look at this answer, which was actually computed by my collaborator here, in the classical effective field theory and compared to this thing, and they agree in a very non-trivial way. So this condenses this expansion in spin and also the expansion in the velocity. So there is no small velocity limit. So there is no post-Newtonian expansion. It's full post-Minkowskian regime. And this, of course, once you have the scattering angle, so someone tells you the deflection as a function of the impact parameter, you can get the potential in some coordinates. And the bound Hamiltonian that you construct from that potential is the thing that you're going to use for the inspired problem. So this is done by, this is currently a work in progress by Simonsen, who is a grad visitor here, and Bynes.
Sorry, can I ask you something? So physically, by your thinking, you have two Kerr black holes that are far away, but they're moving relativistically, and here you're capping the scattering angle of the two?
That's very accurate, yes. There is a scattering of black holes, which is actually not very relevant, because the gravitational waves they emit, they are very hard to detect. But nevertheless, the field equations that control this scattering angle is the same as the in spiral or the bounded trajectory. So the Hamiltonian you get from this guy, which is a completely, you may say, irrelevant situation, the scattering of two black holes, is actually the same Hamiltonian that controls the bounded orbits. And therefore, you can do the matching. Yes?
But isn't there a... I mean, I thought these calculations are valid in the regime where you're far away. You calculate, for instance, the asymptotic scattering angle, presumably, and you're in the radiation regime. So, whereas the in spiral, the part where they're quite close together is already important.
Yes. So in that sense, the post-Minkowskian, so I agree with that, except that there is a refinement in that this calculation, even though it's obtained from far away, it already contains the information from the PN expansion. And the reason is that it's a computation that only assumes a small momentum transfer, which you always assume in the spiral as well, and assumes a given order in G. So assumes perturbation theory in G, and small momentum transfer. So even in the spiral case where these guys are close to each other, you still assume perturbation in G. And therefore, this computation contains the binary computation. Of course, in the binary computation, because it's bounded, you will assume a small velocity. Okay, so what about radiation? So I showed you that radiation can be basically gotten, and so I'm sorry about just putting figures here, but it's just that the formulas are not so pedagogical. So I have to put this figure, and what we do is we take the h-bar to zero limit. And in fact, with Fabian, we show that this limit factorizes the amplitudes into these two parts. So this part you already know is a Compton amplitude, and this is a three-point amplitude. This guy is also is actually some on-shell mode, so it's not some potential mode. But nevertheless, from this thing, you can actually get what you want, which is the radiation field. And it turns out, so this is why I didn't put formulas before, but it turns out that this object is an exponential operator acting on the four-point amplitude. So the four-point amplitude, the classical limit of this guy is trivial to get. It's the thing that you would do in QED. You open Peskin and Schroeder, you get this guy for photons, and now you have to put one index more and get gravitons, because it's also the classical limit, so it's just one channel. You just cut this guy. And this object is, as I told you, more complicated, but nevertheless, it can be written as some kind of translation acting on this trivial guy. So that is, in fact, a realization of the sub-theorem, the fact that you can expand with respect to the energy of the radiated graviton and write that in terms of the amplitude with no radiated graviton. But it turns out that this object is actually all orders in the energy of the radiated graviton. So it's not just a soft theorem, but it's actually all orders in the soft expansion that is controlled by this object, only in the classical limit. So this is just a preview of what we are trying to do now. So it's in fact the most pressing question once you see this formula is how the hell do you get the actual quadruple radiation or the octuple radiation on the scene or the scenes that you want to compute in null infinity. So you will look at these formulas and you will say, where is the quadruple, right? Or where is Einstein's quadruple formula? So let me just show you how to get it. Of course, we would like to get more than the quadruple. We would like to get more the full multiple expansion. But as of now, we only understand this object. And what you do to get the quadruple is that you consider the Lean order in the frequency of the gravity. And then you consider bounded non-relativistic orbits. And why can you do it if you started from a scattering amplitude? Well, because the field equations that give you this guy are the same are the field equations that give you the bounded orbit. So you have to solve this two-body problem. And the field equations are actually the same. The potential is the same. So you can map, or you can get, you're going to get the same solution for the radiated field as a function of the orbit. So once you give me the orbit or the trajectory, I can give you the radiated field. So if you want non-relativistic bounded orbits, then you just simply consider potential modes for the momentum transfer. This is if the guys are close to each other, so there's some momentum transfer which is almost spatial. And you consider an on-shell mode for the radiation, that's the standard, with some frequency, that's not quite true, there's a factor of two somewhere, but with some frequency of the order of B over R, where B is the characteristic velocity of these guys and R is the separation. So, and B is small because this is a bounded orbit. So if you use this thing into the solution that I show you, and you take the Lean order of this, so no exponentials, just this factor, which is a soft factor, multiply that by this guy, you're going to get this object. So this comes from the four-point amplitude and also the soft factor, and there's also this expansion in the velocity, which is the same order as this because it has some energy here. And then you Fourier transform, and when you Fourier transform, you use the bounded, the circular motion. So you can Fourier transform these guys in Q very trivially, and the answer you get is just a quadruple formula. So it's the standard quadruple formula over some word line, two derivatives of time, acting on this guy. So that is the derivation from scattering amplitudes. And that's it.
I wonder, we have Hamiltonian, which is for n particles, with Schaeffer and Ledwinger. Yes. Is this applicable also for n particles? Ledwinger, he did most calculations right for my student. He tried to put their spin, but somehow until now in vain. But I think it's still the difference between scattering of two particles and n body system.
So from the word line point of view, you will have an impact parameter for each pair of word lines. Yeah. So basically, you can just plug I'm just saying it formally. I'm not saying it's easy, but formally you can put a solution with n word lines and start solving instance equations from one word line to another. And eventually, if you do perturbation theory, I don't see why not your why couldn't you get the solution for n particles? From the scattering amplitude point of view, we don't have right now the formalism to include more than two bodies. As in, you can compute an n-body scattering amplitude, but I wouldn't know how to translate that into the actual radiative field. And the reason is that there is some Fourier transform that I didn't explain, but it's somewhere here. So this Fourier transform is only just one Fourier transform acting on the momentum transfer. So this momentum transfer, if you have two guys, is clearly fine. And I'm not sure if you have more guys, this is going to be a trivial extension, but it may be. Yes.
So I understood that there are some soft theorems that guarantee that G is 2 in gravity, which forces it to be true in QED. But why is this true for all orders? Why can you impose this double copy constraint?
Oh, sorry. So the question is, why can we impose the double copy constraint? Is that the question?
Yeah, why can you impose this constraint?
No, oh, sorry. No, that's not...
Why is it satisfied?
Yeah, so the double copy constraint is not something that you can impose. It's something that, well, you impose and then you see you see what it implies. So right now you want to find a criteria that gives you amplitude, that gives you an amplitude which matches the Kerr black hole. And it has been observed by some people that, well, Kerr black hole, of course, admits its Kerr-Schild ansatz. And the Kerr-Schild ansatz can be decomposed into product of two solutions for gauge theory. So the Kerr black hole, in some sense, has a double copy structure. And what we want to do is to mimic that double copy structure, which is classical double copy, if you want. So it's a Kerr-Schild ansatz into the amplitude framework. So we want to reproduce the double copy structure of the Kerr-Schild ansatz from the amplitude. But it's definitely not something that you have to do. It's something that you can impose, and then it turns out that it's consistent to impose other criteria.
I was just wondering, did you have anything to say about the ring dance? It seems that here you're approaching the merger ever so slowly, but could you have something to say about what happens afterwards?
Yeah, I couldn't say much. But what I could probably conjecture is that this information that you can get from the amplitude, which is somehow exploring higher orders in the velocity and higher orders in G, is very well suited to match to the effective one body approach. And in the effective one body approach, you can get information of the ring down or the merger. So that is, of course, a completely different story. And there is a very short region, which is this planche in which you match the inspired with the merger with this EOB thing. But it's nevertheless a constraining information that you can probably use later.
Extension.
Is that just for the potential, or people have to calculate the gravitational waveforms to the orders of the first calculus? Or what's the status of
that? Yeah, that's a very good question. So right now, this is a very state of the art thing, right? So it has been very recently derived. At least this two loop 3 PM potential. So people have compute. I think they have compute scattering angles with it, and probably they are trying to get some predictions. But this is completely new. So as of now, I don't think there are templates of this. It's still under in progress.
Okay. No more questions. Let's take off.